And when you create, so again, going back to Amarok, that central area is just, they have a view that's a, your actual widget. And you just give it the containment that you want associated with it, and it handles all the mapping for you. So you don't really have to worry about mapping the scene graph coordinates into your view. You just create a Plasma view, tell it which containment you want it to look at, and it handles it. If you want to do something more fancy than that, you can, of course, write your own views, but we do provide a view that does what 99% of the applications seem to want to do, which is, here's my view, look at that containment. Does that answer that question decently? So, and then and you can put this, this is a actual, like I said, a top-level widget, so you can put this in your application. So you have your scene, your corona, and you have your view, and you tell the view what part, what containment you want it to be viewing on the corona. And you can, of course, switch that containment around. Yes?
So with multiple desktops, would there be a view per desktop in that case?
With virtual desktops, we don't do that right now. You can switch the containment around on your desktop, so you have multiple sets of things. On a multi-screen system, we have one view per screen, and for each panel, it's also a view. Right. So, yeah. Yes, it means you can't stretch a panel on multiple screens. And the reason, we support that in Kicker and KD3, and I wanted to find and shoot the person who actually put that in there, because there was no end of problems for me. Because of course, and people actually do this, people will have Zenorama layouts where screen 0 is here and screen 1 is below it.
I had that.
Was that you who reported that bug?
And you can't drag the window below the taskbar.
Yeah. That's not my fault. But yes. was it you who reported that bug?
No.
Oh, okay. Someone reported that bug already. But yeah, and when I first saw it, I was like, you know, because I wrote a bunch of code in Plasma to deal with, you know, virtually, you know, we don't make any assumptions as to the layout of the screens. And I thought, well, you've got to, you know, just in case someone, you know, has like a grid of screens, or maybe there's a vertical layout, who do that? And yeah, apparently people do. So, and that's exactly why we don't support. The other thing is that there's no guarantee that screens are the same size. So in KD3, you'd have a panel that would stretch across, and it would, you know, they go, oh, I want to set it on both screens. It lets me do it. It should work right. And it would, you know, you have, you know, this screen and that screen. Yeah, they do see, yeah. The other cool thing about the model view thing is in KD3, we couldn't do hiding of panels across screens. Because the way we were doing it is we were actually physically moving the widget off screen. So of course, it doesn't really work when off screen for screen 0 is actually on screen for screen 1. So you'd hide the panel and you'd see it appear on the other screen. Which is pretty lame. Yeah, so what's cool is that with this model view situation is we actually can just move what we're viewing. We don't change the scene either. We just change the part of the scene we're viewing. So the widget doesn't move, the scene isn't changed, we just change what we're viewing on the scene in that view. And this allows us to move and hide in any direction we want, and we can do cool effects like fade out and whatnot. Yeah, it's such a nicer way of writing a desktop. Another question?
Yes. I have a question about accessibility to artists and mm-hmm. people who are generally just non-developers.
Right.
I'm doing visualization for SCADA engineering and process control and that kind of thing.
Right.
Like our main users are basically engineers. One of the things that really scares them is the right. accessibility to scripting, because
right.
that's what our competitors' packages do, and they mm-hmm. really, really hate it. What do you think about alternative methods such as the animation model defined in SVG?
The animation model in SVG sucks.
Yeah.
There, I've said it. no, it's very limiting, and the way it's implemented, it's very hard to do it efficiently. Yeah, it sucks. So you say they don't want to provide scripting support?
No, they want to. And
oh, they want
the people who are actually using it, who are engineers, hate it because they see code and it scares them.
Ah, right. So when we get to Script Engine, remind me about this, okay? So I can talk about that, because I agree. One of my use cases, actually, I used to work for a financial service, not a financial service company, that was another one. I used to work for a oil and gas trading company. Don't hate me. I used to write risk management software for them, which is a very interesting thing. Any of you think that the economy has any basis in reality? Nope. It's completely random. They had these screens from Reuters, the news feed people, and they have this really freaking cool software where you can put like graphs and news tickers and all these things, and you can create these fancy grids. And Reuters will send a person into your office at a very expensive rate, and they teach you how to reuse the Reuters machine. They actually bring in a desktop machine that you can't use for anything else but Reuters. It belongs to Reuters. Touch it, and they'll shoot you, etc. Send you ninja assassins. And they come in, they teach people how to do it, and the traders loved it because they could make their own little crazy, you know, this is what my world looks like. And they'd make these very complicated layouts with no scripting, none of that, right? It was all GUI, point and click, yada yada, drag things around. And I liked that idea, and I thought, why did Reuters have to create this whole infrastructure to create this application? Why can't we just make it easy to make these kind of applications for anyone? So we get a script engine. Yeah, we'll cover that again about the whole idea of getting of allowing people to code without coding.
Yes.
Great. So form factors. Okay. here we are. Constraints. So when your applet is and these probably should have been blocked together, so I don't have to go back and forth. Whenever the environment that your applet lives in is changes on it, it gets notified. It gets a constraints updated method called. It gets notified that something has changed in its environment. And there's a number of different things that we actually track. We track that your form factor has changed. We're going to talk about form factors in just a second. Your location has changed, meaning that you used to be on the edge of a screen. You're now floating about freely, or you're now on the left side of the screen as opposed to the right side of the screen. Your screen has changed. This is a kind of a desktop thing that most applications won't care about, but we needed the ability to say, you were on screen zero, you're now on screen one. This is useful if you're a full screen widget and you want to actually change your size in response to being on a physical screen. We let you know when your size has changed. Remember how I mentioned that we basically give you one axis of freedom, otherwise it's a bug, right? You can change your width based on the height or the height based on the width. So the way we trigger this in widgets is we actually tell them your size has changed. Your immutability has changed. This is for locking down your widget. So you actually say, here's a widget, but don't let people touch it. Right? So the Amarok people, for instance, they do a layout, and they don't want people to be able to freely drag them around. So they set immutable to true. Whenever your immutability changes, you get notified of that. You also get notified when startup is completed. And this is really important, because the configuration stuff I talked about, you're actually not allowed to touch the configuration object until your init method is called. I won't go into why, but trust me, you don't want to do it. So one of those constraints is the form factor. And form factors, we have four of them at the moment. I expect these to grow over time. But we've got Planner, which is essentially it's a plan. You have two dimensions of freedom. It's an infinite grid. Go crazy. We have Media Center, which is designed for basically it gives you the hint that you're working in a 10-foot UI. So you with a remote, right? So instead of being up close like this, you're actually sitting back on your couch and you're watching the telly, right? So you may want to adjust how the layout of your widget looks. And works depending on whether it's sitting on a two-dimensional plane that's going to be close versus a media center. Yes.
Can you change your interface mechanism at that point as well?
Yes.
Can you modify interface mechanism?
That's exactly
as well?
Why we tell you about it.
Cool.
That's exactly the idea. We want people to create widgets that travel, right? So I can pull it off my phone and put it on my television, and it adjusts radically. What does that mean? That's a very widget specific thing. So what we do is we make sure that you always know when things have changed, and then we let you know what the change was. And you can also be we also have horizontal and vertical, and this means that you are in a vertically or horizontally constrained space. So in desktop terms, you might have a panel that sits on the left or right side. So you don't want your widget to be trying to show more information left to right. You actually want to start it vertically. So the taskbar, for instance, that shows all your windows. Unless you click on them and switch between them, and when it's vertically constrained, it stacks them. When it's horizontally constrained, it lays them out left to right. So, now, how do you get access to that information? So, we have methods such as form factor, location, geometry. So, what happens is constraints updated gets called. You can re-implement this. And it tells you which constraints have changed. It's a bit mask. So you can go, did my form factor constraint change? And if it did, you can then ask, what is my form factor now? And then you can adjust your user interface based on that. The other nice thing about this is that you then don't have to, in your code, always be checking for what your form factor is. You'll be told when it changes. This goes back to the efficiency thing. One of the things we learned is that to make flexible widgets, people had all these multiple code paths, which you're checking all the time, and it really increases the load. So this allows you to change only when necessary, exactly when necessary. Yes?
The other form factor that I can immediately think of is a phone.
Right. Right.
Like, really tiny device.
We're actually...
Radical UI sort of change.
The interesting thing about phones, and the reason why we don't have that form factor in yet, we're actually doing the R&D on that right now. And the reason is because phone is interesting. Because you have, like, the Cisco VoIP phones, which actually have a reasonable size display.
Yeah.
Then you've got, phones in Japan that have, like, wicked-ass displays, right? Beautiful, beautiful, 800 by 600, push as many polygons as you want. Then you have, the phones that most people have where I come from, which are little crappy screens. So, right. So we're right now trying to figure out what's a very elegant, efficient way of capturing that. And that's why I haven't put it in yet. We try and be a little careful about what we do provide. But yes, we are going to eventually provide a set of handheld constraints. Hello, you can come in. Come in, say hi. Random people. I like accosting people randomly. Makes them feel uncomfortable. So, that's how form factors work. You can also define whether or not you have a configuration interface. So you say set has configuration interface true. That's how we know to do things like, I'm going to close that. There we are. Beauty. I'm actually running from SVN. This is the bleeding edge as of yesterday code. I run all my production machines on that. It's called eating your own dog food and it hurts. So that is how we know to show the configuration button or not, because there is no configuration on some of these things. If it's true, you may eventually get called your method show configuration interface. And this is also probably changing, because right now we expect your applet to actually do the entire creation and management of the configuration interface. And I'm not liking that anymore. It kind of sucks. So why is my panel in front of it? There we are. So we're probably going to be changing that slightly to where we ask you to create the widget, but then we manage it ourselves. This also makes it a lot more consistent with how we do the scripting. And then there's a lot of little detail items, such as if you cause a window focusing event to happen, so you launch an application, or if your taskbar, you switch the application, you need to emit or call launch activated. And this lets the host application do things to get out of the way. So for instance, if I have my taskbar here, and I call it forward, if I actually select, right, so show the use case here. So I may be on a device that doesn't have a panel, right, obviously. If you've used a Moblin or the Nokia N800 or whatnot, right, they actually put the small screen space, they give the application the entire space. The idea of a panel is actually kind of mutated on these devices, and for good reason. So we can kind of emulate this by bringing them forward. And if I now select a different window, right, it then causes the launch activated signal to be emitted and makes the dashboard go away. Whoa. Okay. That kind of sucked. Oh, okay. So what's my other? I don't use Impress. I hate Impress. Impress is a really bad application, in case anybody's wondering. The other which? There we are. Great. Thank you. And there's a really bad typo. Engine. God, I can't type. So we give you access to this thing called a data engine. And the way you use it is you basically say, in your applet, you basically ask for the data model by name. So you say, give me a time. Now, what does this actually do? I'm glad you asked, because we're going to talk about data acquisition now. Whoa. That didn't actually look like that when I did it. Although that's probably better than what I had. So data acquisition. We still have work to do in between, obviously, KOffice and OpenOffice and actually getting all the file formats to work properly. That is funky. And those are actually the same paths. And it's completely different.
Wow.
But I actually copy and pasted them, so the order should be the same. Anyways, all right, whatever. So the idea behind data acquisition is that there's this world of information out there, right? And what Data Engine does, it sits between the world and the visualizations and provides a standardized way of accessing that information. Whether it's weather data or time data or stock ticker or a news or RSS feed reader or whatever, the person that's running the visualization for it has the exact same interface to it, regardless of the data. And you'll see why this is actually really cool in a bit. Question?
Could that be an actual local database?
Absolutely. We make no assumptions as to what that is. And that's the whole point of it. It's an abstraction between the world and the visualization. Absolutely. So that's actually how we do the device notification. When you plug something in, HAL tells us about it on Linux, and so Solid says, "Bonk, we have a new device." And that actually gets fed into a data engine, and then the device notifier visualization responds to the fact that there's this new data source, and it then visualizes it. It doesn't actually know that there's this idea of a device per se, right? We have ones for Windows, so you can write a taskbar using the data engine. And of course, time, because it's all about clocks. So how does this work? Well, essentially, every data engine provides a list of what we call sources. In time, that might be the time zone, right? So, and we use it by, cities, so Edmonton or Melbourne or local time zone or UTC. Each source can have zero or more key value pairs. The keys are always strings, but the value can be anything. We wrap it in a variant. So it could be a number, it could be text, it could be an image, it can be whatever you really want. And what's nice is at runtime, we can actually ask, what is this thing? And then we can decide how to display it. Engines are updated in one of two ways. Either on demand, so when a visualization comes along and says, I would like to know what the time is, please, right now, the engine will then be prompted to update that information. Or it can also be done via timing. So the visualization can say, please tell me about the time once a minute on the minute. And the engine will then be prompted once a minute on the minute to update that given source. All this magic is handled for you in behind the scenes. Question? You just leave it with him. He's going to have all the questions.
If you have a visualization provider that's requesting an update every 30 seconds for the weather, and it's only actually updated from the source every 2 hours?
Great question. And when we look at the API, we'll actually see how to stop people doing stupid things like that. So every engine there's only ever one instance of it per application. So if you have 14 clocks, you only have one time engine running. If you have 14 clocks all looking at local time, you only have one data source. So we do all the sharing, and all the sharing is actually managed for you in behind the scenes. If a clock pops up, it asks for the time in Melbourne, like my desktop clock is, and then I put the clock away, that source that was dynamically requested is automatically removed for you. So when you're running an engine, you just concentrate on actually getting the data and then populating the sources. You don't worry about timing. You don't worry about resource usage or consumption or sharing. That's all done behind the scenes for you using magic. Only in interfaces, but magic is awesome in code. We have little wood elves that run through the forest writing code. I'm not sure where I was going with that one. I had a destination in mind, I completely missed it. Okay, so this is really nice because it helps with efficiency. So if you have, for instance, data that needs to be, you know, you can only be accessing the actual source of data with one thing at a time. So say it's actually, you know, some sort of hardware device, and you open up an actual serial connection to it. You don't have to worry in your engine about multiple connections to it. It's all handled for you. So that's one of the really cool things about nicely designed APIs, is it can handle all the tricky bits. Using the data engine is really, really simple. You do, as I said, you know, data engine, engine name, and then what you do in your widget is you call connect source, you give it the source name, you tell it what to send that information to. So in this case, we're saying I am the visualization. But in your widget, you might have, you know, three different bar charts, for instance, and you might want to put a different stock price in each one of those charts. So you'd say, load up the stock ticker engine or the stock engine, connect, you know, Nokia. What's their NOK? Something like that. To, you know, that chart, chart A, and the number here is how often you want to be updated. So in this case, I'm wanting to be updated 10 times a second, which is really a lot. What's interesting is that whenever it's required in your engine, the data updated method, in your widget, the data updated method will be called. So that you basically say, I want to know information about foo from bar engine, and then your widget will be told whenever there's an update. This is partly how we solve the every 30 seconds issue. Ors requested. May the Ors be with you. And apparently I forgot to do the init as well. So the first one that happens is init. The init method in your engine gets called exactly once, the first time it's loaded. So if you have any construction work to do, so for instance the hot plug engine, it needs to set up the dbus connection to HAL. It doesn't want to do this over and over and over again, it wants to do it exactly once. So it does that in its init method. When init gets called, you can assume that the entire environment is up and running and everything's kosher and cool, and you can start doing any construction that you need to do for it to be able to actually source data. You don't have to implement init. Init but has a default implementation that does exactly nothing. Then you have source requested. Source requested, what this is if time is interesting, that's why I actually did time engine and a clock, because time is a really interesting set of problems. One of them is there's a lot of time zones in the world, and a lot of different cities and whatnot. And what's interesting is you can't just have 24 of them, because morons around the world have decided they're going to put little, you know, daylight savings times rules in, and they're not the same. So they change. Yeah, I was shocked to find that GMT is not constant. UTC is, but not GMT. Who's? We're obviously letting the wrong people manage time. But it makes a really great test case. So the thing is, we don't want to have to create a table for, you know, all n thousand cities in the world. That'd be a waste of memory, right? And processor cycles to update them all. So when the clock says, show me Melbourne time does not exist yet in the engine. What happens in the engine is it gets a source requested call with the name of the source. The engine can then decide whether or not to actually create a data source called Melbourne. So what the time engine does, it looks up in its infinite wisdom. So we've got different, these are all a set of different engines I have installed on my laptop right now. So you can look, do dictionary lookups and file browsers, so you can actually point at a folder and you'll get a list of everything, the files in there. When they get deleted or updated, you actually get signal. It's kind of neat. Twitter, see? Twitter's there. Bonk. So time. So if I ask for a local time, I can say how much update. Now you notice that there's no data being delivered here right now. But since I request it, the source requested method got called. It said, okay, I know how to do local time. It thinks local time is Edmonton. But I could put Melbourne in there instead, and it would create on demand that source. So it allows you to create or have engines that don't have to supply the entire world of data, just the data that's actually being used at that time. And when it stopped being used, of course, then that source automatically goes away. Yes?
Can you find out stop being used because the window is not currently active?
No, it stops being used because there are no longer any visualizations that are waiting for data from it or using that data.
So are the apps so much not called that data room should as well be actually seeable?
On the Plasma desktop, the K4 desktop, we don't do that yet, no. We will be eventually.
Is it possible to ask a data engine what sources it provides?
Absolutely. There is a method called sources, and you return a string list. And by default, it returns the list of existing sources. But if you are, say, a time engine, you can actually return a list that is all the times or all these cities that it knows it could create a source for. And that's actually how the weather engine works. Right? Because you actually ask it and it returns a... Yep. Question?
Yeah. I noticed in your Explorer window you had back there,
right.
It looked like the time was updating dynamically. We were just watching it there.
Absolutely.
So is that the data engine there continuously going back and querying, say, the... I don't know what it's querying, but...
So what it does is every... In that case, because I said, give me every 500 milliseconds, update source... was being called every half second, asking to update the local source. And that gets handled for you automatically. and what's neat is, you can have multiple visualizations, all looking at the same source, at different update intervals, and it just works. And they actually share the same source, they get updated at the right time, and all you have to implement in your engine is source requested and update source. And everything else gets handled for you. This also makes it really easy to put this into the scripting world, right? Because we didn't want people to have to create, you know, do all this. I mean, we give people like a really nice tool, a script tool, right, to be able to write really, you know, scripts in 5 minutes, but then we make them write all this timing code and stuff. It's like, no. So, now how do you actually get the data into the source? Well, we've got set data, clear data, and remove data, and those do exactly what you think they would. They take the key they take the source. So local time or Melbourne time, they take the key and the value. So here we've got the data source is local, and then we've got our key value pairs. This is actually, here, a time. That's actually a date time object. It's not text. It's an actual date time object. Right, so what's really cool is when we actually view it in this view, this visualization, it only does text. Because I just whipped it up, you know. Anyways, so what we do is we ask each, we go, give me all of the keys for the source, and then we ask, can I get the value in text, please? And of course, there's the ability to go from a date time object to text. It's built into Qt, and so I get it back as text. For all of this view is aware of, it's just getting, you know, the time in a string. When really there's a much more interesting object in behind it. And of course you can get directly to the object. So if you are, you know, a more complex widget that actually knows how to deal with dates and times, you can actually request and then get the actual date time object and manipulate it. Absolutely. The question was, can you do, you know, partial conversions and whatnot? Absolutely. Pardon me. So your question was, how do you prevent someone from trying to update every 30 seconds when, say, the web services API agreement that you've signed off on says, don't ping it more than once every 10 minutes, and getting you, therefore, into trouble with Amazon?
Well, also, how do you stop the resource utilization if you're calling this thing mm-hmm. all the time and there's no new
right.
data?
Exactly. So that's the other thing. Update source. If there is no new data and you don't update the source, the visualization won't get an update triggered. Right? So we try and like prevent as much processing as possible. But you can set an update interval. So let's say that you are an engine that has a natural internal rhythm, and you want to update everything in your engine every minute, just because. Say, for instance, an RSS feed, you know, you want to set a regular tick. You can actually set the update interval for the entire engine, so you can say every 10 minutes. And then every 10 minutes, you'll actually get source update source called in every one of your sources. Oops. You can also set the minimum update interval. So in your case, let's say you don't want to update more than every 10 minutes because it's just ridiculous. When you set an update interval of 10 minutes, and the widget, the visualization says, I want to be updated every 30 seconds, what happens is that the engine goes, okay, well, we updated you 30 seconds ago. I'm not allowed to actually get new data more than every 10 minutes, so I'm just going to tell you this is new data. And so the visualization gets updated every 30 seconds, but the engine actually doesn't do any work more than once every 10 minutes. So we actually manage that rather nicely in between. So you can set limits. Question in the back there?
Yeah, just back to the time and clock thing. If you've got something like the data engine can't connect to the data source,
right.
You're getting your time over the network or
right.
something,
yep.
you pull out the network plug, you pull out your,
right.
your cable, does that stop time or...
Stop time. Yes.
Is there a way to get the age of the data, how long it's been, whether or not it was successfully retrieved, and so forth?
That's actually an interesting question. We actually do keep that information internally as part of the state of the source. We don't expose that though. If you would find that interesting, ask me for it. It's actually not a bad idea to add that to the API. The engine. No, visualizations do not do anything with data acquisition. No manipulation. People keep asking me for read-write engines, and we're almost certainly going to provide another interface that you can use for writing. Data engine is specifically read-only because that allows us to do all the control in the engine. Yes. So the question was, can you actually see who's subscribing to that information from the engine? No. Because what that would do is it would encourage people to actually tie visualization work into the engine, and that's bad. We really enforce the separation. So at the end of the day, this is what it allows us to do. It allows me to view the time in a tree. It also allows me to, let me see, so many of the clocks I have installed on this. That was a typo. We don't have a clock widget? My God, I'll be right back. Maybe that was, maybe I should change my, okay, so. So here are, oops. Oh, they changed that from window shade to maximize. God, I hate that. So here I have four different clocks. Three of them are viewing the same time data in four different, very different ways. We also have one that actually does like an old school train thing where whenever it changes, the numbers go thuk, thuk. It's really cool. The time engine has no concept about how the data is going to be visualized. In fact, it might not even be used in a clock. It might be used in something completely different. The weather engine's really crazy because it actually chains engines together. So it actually asks for the weather from the BBC, from the BBC engine, asks for the Environment Canada data from the Environment Canada engine, but then it feeds it into a top-level weather engine, and that's what the visualization sees. So the engines that are for BBC and whatnot, they have no idea that they're actually not being visualized at all directly. Right? So it's really neat that we can do this. And so what the guy did who did the binary clock, for instance, right, is he did the little algorithm to paint a binary clock, which is, of course, very cool and geeky. Yes. it's one of those useless things. But anyways, and what's cool is that he was able then to just plug in the time data. You could take this visualization, and you could plug in any numerical data, really. I suppose, and it would show it. So it allows us to separate visualization and data and gives people the ability to then create new pairings. Right? It's kind of like the salad bar. You know, what kind of lettuce do you want? What kind of dressing would you like? And it allows people to put them together. In the scripting problem of, how can we get away from scripting? Well, we allow people to create visualizations, get other people to create engines, and one of our goals, probably it's on our 4.2 roadmap right now, is to, we've got the packaging part of it done, we need to get the actual point-and-click part, but it's to allow people, we've got the engine explorer, so you can go through the engines and pick, this engine, that engine, that source, and then pick from a list of widgets which, you know, visualization you want, and then just connect them. That's the beauty of APIs. Okay, so those are data engines. We've got like 20 minutes. So runners. Any other questions about engines and visualizations before we move on?
Something on a conceptual level.
Yes.
You said that if data is only provided every 2 hours.
He's speaking in a microphone that's coming out of my shirt. Go on.
So, question on a conceptual level. You said that if a data source can actually only provide data every 2 hours and something is querying it every 30 seconds,
right.
Why do you nevertheless provide it every 30 seconds? It seems to me that you're straying from a thing of visualization of this data, because if the data isn't changing every 2 hours, then it seems wrong. It seems to be encouraging something other than plain visualization.
Well, that's because we don't actually know what the visualization is going to do. So imagine a spinning cube, if you will. Oh, I just broke it. No, I didn't. I didn't break it. imagine a spinning cube, for instance. And let's say it spins on its axis once every 30 seconds. And it doesn't want to locally cache the data, because that's what engines are all about. Right? You can view the engine as a local data cache if you want. So it needs to get that data again every 30 seconds. So it could say, update me every 30 seconds. And could use that data update every 30 seconds to also trigger the spinning of the cube. We don't know what visualizations are going to do. Assumptions are bad, horrible, and evil, and lead to limitations in what we can actually do with it. So there's we do work with use cases, obviously, otherwise we'd be, you know, designing out into the blue sky, but we try to avoid saying those are the only use cases. So we'll put a whole bunch of use cases on the table, or on the mailing list, as the case may be, and we say, what is the generalization here? And we're trying to, you know, get as many different use cases, and then we design to the generalization. And oftentimes, creating a generalization means removing as many assumptions as possible, such as, well, if there is no data, the widget would not actually need to be updated. And it actually turned out that, and it's interesting because that was originally how I wrote it, and within a couple of weeks someone showed up with a widget that proved me horribly, horribly wrong. And they had written it in such a way that it was relying on these updates to actually trigger painting events and you know, in their visualization. And I could tell them, well, you're doing it wrong, or I could go, it should just work. So because of that, I changed the way that worked long before, about a year ago at this point, simply because people expected it. And that's kind of interesting. You design an API and you give it to people and you see how they interpret it. It's really interesting because people will look at your API and think you're saying one thing when you actually mean to say another thing. If anybody designs libraries here, make sure you've got applications that someone else is writing while you're designing your library, because they will show you every way you're wrong very quickly. Yes, Ian. No, because the question was, can we just say there's a set output of status says no change? And no. And the reason is because we try and limit the number of extra pieces of data that get shipped along, because that just encourages people to write more code paths, and it makes it harder to write a graphical editor, point-and-click editor, and it makes it more difficult for the average Joe. I mean, we really want people that have never done anything besides HTML and JavaScript to be able to whip up really cool-looking complex things. So every level of extra cleverness that gets put onto the creator, we put all kinds of magic inside the library, but we try and export as little as possible so that it's as simple and clean and clear as possible to actually create things with it.
Just a quick question.
Yep.
Can the data engines be written in a scripting language themselves?
Yes, as of last week. You can write them in ECMAScript or Python. Boom. one last question from the one. Oh, well, if you want to write a visualization that's actually you know, friendly and whatnot, you will often only, you don't have to say update me every if you don't provide a timing, I probably should cover that. If you don't say update me every so many milliseconds, you only get an update when the data changes. I probably skipped over that again. Yeah, I'm so used to all this stuff. So yeah, if you don't say update me every so many milliseconds, you get updates only when data changes. Right? You don't really see, yeah. So for the clock, that's irrelevant. But right. So the RSS feeds, for instance, are like that. only when the Atom RSS feed actually changes, then you get a signal. Unless you say update me every 10 minutes. But that way, it allows you, if you don't care about timely updates, like timed updates, you only get timely updates, right? So, yes. Sorry, I glossed over that. My bad. Probably answers your question as well, Ian. So, runners. So we've only got 10 minutes left. runners. Has anybody here used Quicksilver on Mac? Right. And it spawned all kinds of imposters, right? There's a Catapult for KDE. The guys at Humanized, they had a really cool little thing. Now they're working at Firefox. There's a recent one for GNOME, GNOME Duo, I think it's called. Yeah. Anyways, so I figured that was a really great idea. And the problem with all of these solutions, and please excuse the ugliness of the UI, it's being changed. But I figured that the problem with all these tools is that they weren't standard pieces of the desktop. They were these little add-ons. And what was really frustrating, at least for me, is I felt, I still feel, that they are probably the most human way of interacting with a machine, or at least one of the more human ways. I should be able to just type in a random word or phrase, and the computer should go out and figure out what the hell I'm actually asking, right? So if I search for, you know, hippopotamus, it should show me all the hippopotamus pictures I have. If I say, you know, spreadsheet, it should allow me to pick between, you know, the spreadsheet programs I have installed and decide which one to launch. I should be able to do actions. I should be able to do verbs on nouns. I should be able to, you know, type in, you know, things and get, you know, mathematical results. I should be able to do Google searches, right? I should be able to teach it new things. So that, of course, the first thing I did was went and designed an API for it, because that's what I do. So we have this thing called runner, abstract runner, actually. As you can see, the API is still evolving, 4.1. What the runner does is the user's typing away in the run dialog, and of course you can still, you know, do commands. But what happens is that this, as you're typing, it gets fed to the runner, and the host application says, "Do you know what this is?" And the runner says, "Why, yes, I do," or "No freaking clue, man." And it then goes through all the runners. Now, the runners are plugins, right? They're components, so we can easily add to them. And yes, you can script them before you ask, in both ECMAScript and Python, as of last week. And the guy who did the Python one actually used Cross, so we might get Ruby for free. I haven't actually looked. Anyways, so in the C++ API, you get told whenever there is a... there we are. Whenever there's a query to match against, and then you can provide three different kinds of results. One would be an exact match, and that would be binls. I know exactly what that is. That is a program that sits on disk right there. Or maybe it's a full path to a file. You go, yeah, exactly, right there. So that's one kind of match. The other kind of match is a possible match, and we allow waiting between 0 and 1. And you say how much it matches. So the person types in hippopotamus, and you go, well, here's a file that mentions hippopotami. Maybe you want this one, but I'm not really sure. It only mentions it once, so we're going to give it a 0.1. It's not very relevant. And you can provide multiple possible matches, as well as multiple exact matches. And there's informational matches. When I typed up that equation, it gave me an answer, right? Well, it's informational. It's not actually, you know, anything beyond just informational. Anything about informational ones is that if I hit enter here, it'll actually replace it with the information. So we can actually go from one set of information to another set of information using this interface. The idea being that there's a runner being made right now that allows you to teach it. So that you can actually type in, say, teach foo, and it comes up, I know exactly what to do with that. I'm going to, you know, teach me. And you select that, so you do teach foo, hit enter, and then the next thing you type in becomes associated from that point forward with foo. So you can teach it things really easily. Next time you type in foo, enter, it'll actually do whatever you just taught it. And you can actually provide little ECMAScripts, so you can actually do really wicked, crazy things. So that'd be an informational match, right? The one little trick is that they're threaded. We wanted to make it really interactive, because you're just typing away, da-da-da-da-da, and some of these things take a long time. Querying this search database is not the fastest thing in the world. I mean, it's fast enough, but not while I'm typing. And we wanted to match as you were typing, right? So, you know, it's really neat, because I can type in, there, a spreadsheet. Boop. I can just type in spread, or even S-P-R-E, I get lots more, but spread, and I can enter, and it would launch OpenOffice Calc, for instance, here. Or I could select if I want instead K-spread. So we want to do it as you were typing, because we don't know when the user's actually done. So we actually ask the runners, hey, can you help them now? Can you help them now? Can you help them now? So to make this interactive so you can actually type, even while you know some of our slower runners are moving like molasses, it's threaded. Each runner runs in its own thread. Interesting. So you have to be kind of careful that you're not doing anything that assumes that you're in a single thread application inside of your runner. So new texts are good. Yes? Okay, question.
So could you possibly have an informational runner that was found documentation? So when you type bin ls, you got bin ls, but also man page for bin ls, blah, 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 blah.
Absolutely. I did break it. Oh, no. Oh, I see how it works. Yeah, clever. yeah, that's exactly why we did it that way, was so that you can actually, we don't assume what a runner will do. Again, we no assumptions, right? And so it turns the run dialog into this really cool, handy little thing that you can do pretty much anything with. And as a runner developer, you get to define what it does. Because yeah, you could pop up the man page if you wanted.
Another one?
Yes.
And I guess along those lines, have you thought of, I guess, more contextual things? So for instance, you might type, say, timetable, but you,
right.
you learn maybe, for instance, at a time of day, you know, that you're looking for the train timetable. If you've just previously opened a whole bunch of C files and you type, open, then you're actually more likely looking for a man page than for doing something else. So,
absolutely.
I mean, I know this becomes more like a HAL 9000 sort of thing, but...
That's where we're trying to head.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's interesting when you create the right tools and put them in the hands of people like you, amazing things happen. I'm just a tool maker. Anyways, so the key API. When you're writing a runner, creating a runner, the match method is the most important one. This gets called whenever we figure that you should be doing a match. And you get handed a search context. We'll get to that in a second. When the user says, please do that, your exec method is called. When you can also provide configuration, both for individual match returns, as well as for your entire runner. And that's where the create match options and create configuration interface are for. Create match options allows you to define a widget that would then allow the user to customize whatever that match is. So, I really don't have an option example off the top of my head. Someone asked for it, so I added it to the API. configuration interface allows you to configure. So, for instance, if you had a runner that looked up information from dictionaries online, you might want to let the user define or control which dictionary, online dictionary. So you can do that. So when your match method gets called, you get this search context. And the search context is where we actually synchronize all the threads. What you're going to do is, and the search context also serves as the collection point for all the actions. Okay? So you can figure out what you're going to do with this match in your runner, and then when you're all done, you call add matches on the search context object with the search term that you were given, your list of exact matches, your list of possible matches, and your list of informational matches. And it's kind of an ugly API because we do it all at once, but the reason is because when they're all threaded, and because it's a shared resource, we have to lock it for writing, and so if we actually did three calls, you have to walk it three times. If you multiply that by, you know, 15 or 20 runners, and you're actually, the user is expecting to actually be able to type and it keep up, it really slowed things down. Because the locking happens in the main thread where they're typing, right? So we kind of uglified the API to achieve interactive speed, even on slow devices. You know, I didn't notice it on my laptop, but people that are running it on little machines were complaining. So you can also do string completion, so autocomplete, and it pops up in the autocomplete box. You can also add those. Search context also provides information about what's being searched for. It provides the search term, which is what I'm typing. It provides the type. It tries to figure out what kind of thing it is, and it'll say, oh, this, I think this is a URL, or this could be a domain name, or this could be a file, or this could be, and so it provides that, and there's a type enumeration. We're kind of running out of time, so we're going to go quick. And then there's the MIME type. If it is a file, whatnot, you can do the MIME type. And the reason why I get the search context to do this is because we can do it in the library, we can do it properly, and we can do it very fast. And then we do it once, and then every runner that is MIME type based doesn't have to check the MIME type. That's another thing we're finding is that people are writing all these runners that required the MIME type, and so every runner was looking for the MIME type. And of course, that's not always the fastest thing in the world. So we do it once for you in the search context. Okay, so that's runners. I'm sorry for going quickly because I'm out of time in like 1 minute. Animation. I love this stuff. So when you hover over this dude, he pops in and out, right? Dunk, 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 dunk. Really cool. Okay. If you watch the taskbar down below, let's open a few of these. You actually notice that it too is animated. When things move. Actually, I'm going to turn off compositing because it's easier to see. Because for whatever reason, well, I know why. It's because I'm using the extra render path because the OpenGL is screwed at the moment on my chipset. All right. So watch when I close, say, this guy. Shunk. See how that goes? It's pretty cool, huh? I think I'm easily amused, maybe. Okay. Little things excite me. So all that animation is not actually done in the taskbar or in the toolbox that hovers coming out of the corner. We actually provide a infrastructure for providing animation. It's called Phase Animator. And these are two pieces. You can write animator plugins that actually provide animations. So we can change what the animations actually do. And they're semantic. So you say, make this item appear. Make this item fade out. Make this item, I don't know, dance, whatever. We don't actually have a dance yet, but maybe. so you tell it what you want it to do, on what item or element, and the animator actually does the animation. Phase coordinates all the animations. So even if you have 40, then this is the problem, right? Let's say we want to animate everything. If you have 40 animations, and they're all, you know, clicking at every 40 milliseconds, doing the math and statistical distribution, you're going to have, every millisecond, you're going to have something being moved around and animated. And that really is not fun for the battery. So phase, and it also means that your animations don't move together. And the eye is really amazing. The human eye can actually detect, although most people won't be able to verbalize what they're seeing, they'll go, it doesn't look right, because something is moving 5 milliseconds ahead of the other one. The eyes are so amazing. So phase coordinates everything. You make requests to phase to animate things, and it animates all the animations on a single animation tick. No matter how many animations, what the speed is, what the curve is on them, it animates all of them on a single tick. This is very nice for the battery and also coordinates all the animations. So essentially, it's a singleton. So you ask for the singleton. And to actually move those items out from the toolbox, that's the code. Right there. Oh, part of the code. No, that is the code. Oh, okay, yeah, the next one. So what it does is it's only part of the code. Where the hell is the rest of it? Anyways, so this is the actual line that does the animation. Oh, no, that is. Right. Sorry, I'm confused. I'm like, what the hell? It's the multiple font sizes. That's it, yeah. So this is the actual code that actually moves the item. We actually say slide out, and we tell it where we want it to slide out to, and the animator then takes over from there and just does whatever slide out means. The beautiful thing about this is because it's plugin based, how many people here run thin client stuff? Right. So it really pisses you off when we animate things, right? So we just load the null animator animator, and all of a sudden nothing animates. Things just go pop, 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 and we just remove all the in-between frames. The widget, your visualization, is not written for this. It doesn't know anything strange is happening. It just simply works. To do the arc moving out, yeah, this is a little more involved. we do the same thing. We ask for a custom animation, because we realize we can't provide every animation possible. We won't have thought of everything. and as you can notice, you define the frames, how long it should last for, the curve, because animation isn't always linear. Sometimes you want it to start slow and then go really fast, right? So you can define the curve, and then what you're animating, and then you tell it what method to call. And your animate, in this case animate method, will get called with the progress. The progress is 0 to 1. So you don't worry about what frame you're at. So if it skips frames, right, because your CPU gets busy doing something else and so you didn't get called quick enough, it just silently discards frames for you. So you'll get called between 0 and 1, which is the progress of how much of the animation is done. So you get like 10, or 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, or whatever, depending on how many frames, how fast, and how busy the CPU has been. We do all that for you. So here we do is, if we're showing it, we just use it. We basically invert the value depending on whether we're showing or hiding. And then we update. We call update. And this just gets called automatically. And again, with the null animator, you just get called the end frame. One. So it just goes pop, 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 as opposed to animating. So that all the people running thin client software don't take contracts out of my head. I don't have time to go through packages, unfortunately. Frustrating. So much to do. So much to do. So packages are basically a way of bundling up all the data you need for a widget and putting it together and being able to throw it around. Toop. And what's neat is this is not specific to Plasma. You define the structure of the package in your code, and this creates basically a contract between the package creators and the package users. And then you can actually say, is this package valid? Does it have all the required bits? And then you can actually ask, give me the main script. And we've, in the Plasmoids, we actually say that the main script lives at a certain place in the file system, in the package. But the application doesn't know where that is. It doesn't need to. It just asks, give me the main script. Because it's, again, semantics. It's semantic-based, which allows us to adjust the package, allows us to create automatic package creators that are very intelligent and smart. The scripting stuff, we basically have a class called ScriptEngine that you can subclass, and you can create scripting support for runners, engines, and applets or widgets. And basically what happens is, again, internally behind your back, we simply load up the script engine and we start forwarding calls into your script. But it's just an API. You can do anything you want with your script engine. You get to define what the API is for your support. So even because we have one ECMAScript engine now, one Python script, you might not like the script API, that it's, the way it's exposed it. You can write another one. And this happens dynamically. So the package actually says, I am JavaScript. And then the system says, do we know anybody that does JavaScript? And then the little ECMAScript guy goes, I do. And then we load him, and we give him the package. It's kind of the way it works in 30 seconds. Harass me with questions, challenge my ideas, do things we have not thought of before. That is what turns me on. Well, it gets me excited. There's no way, nice way of saying that. you can email, my email address is asaigo@kd.org, but we've actually got the mailing list, panel-devel@kd.org, or visit us on IRC in Pound Plasma. I hope to see many of you doing really cool things, again, that I had never thought of, and definitely challenge my ideas. So that's my presentation. I think we've got, yes, Ian, real quick. Yeah, you can harass me later with questions. We've got do you want to come up? Sure. We have a little surprise for you, I think.
We do have a little surprise.
Do we have the mic? Mic?
Stu Laren's
mic? Yeah, sure. No. There we are.
Okay. We do have a little surprise. I thought we'd save it for the end. Thank you, Aaron, for your presentation. I thought that was fantastic and enlightening, so thank you.
Every villain needs a lap cat. I have a lap penguin.
And we've got two special guests today, Ross from Sun, and another gentleman by the name of David, from Frontline, who are going to present a little surprise to the KDE project. So please come up and welcome David and Ross.
Okay, thank you, Carl. Before I came here today, someone said, well, there'll only be two people in the room with a suit and a bald head. Someone who's giving away something, someone who's receiving something. Well, in this case, there's two of us giving away something, and it's our pleasure, in fact, if you could just... Sun Microsystems, in conjunction with Frontline, who are one of our major distributors in this country, are very pleased to donate a Sun X4200 server to the KDE project. This is something we worked with Carl over the last few weeks to put together. And this certificate is, I've got a few of these, so they can be taken back to the US with those that are here from other countries also. And this is, it's Sun's pleasure to do this. We, as most people would be aware, are very strong in the open source community. And Sun, in fact, has open sourced Solaris. It's also open sourced a number of other products over time, Java, Genie, and those sorts of facilities, which of course, I do very little with because I just sell the stuff, but you guys are the ones that actually make it all work. And interestingly, most recently, MySQL also has come under the Sun umbrella, so we're hoping to see great things from there. So the open source community is alive and well. Sun appreciates it, Sun values it, and this is part of our contribution to that organisation. Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the KDE project, and particularly our nonprofit that's based in Germany, KDEV, which that's the other thing I do. I'm also a kind of a management wonk. They let me run that thing for some reason. I'd like to say thank you very much. We'll put that to great use. Obviously, as a free software project that spans the globe, we rely on the support of industry. It's a very symbiotic relationship, and we're proud to accept this, and we'll put it to excellent use. Thank you very much. And I still have donuts, so if anybody wants a donut, please, because otherwise yes.